main speaker for this morning. I had the privilege of having a rather long chit-chat with John when I got to invite him to come here, well, to see if the program committee would invite him to come up here and to share with us. And I've had the privilege of spending some time with him this weekend and getting to know him. And I think we're all in for a real treat. So please help me welcome John from San Francisco.
Good morning. My name is John, and I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon and Alateen family group. Thank you, Joao, for that nice introduction, and to Peter, and I know Keith, who's not here this morning, for just being really lovely hosts and making me feel very welcome and very comfortable here. And I want to thank Christine. It was really great to meet you, and Kristen and Michelle, the other speakers, made this a fantastic weekend for me. I've heard so much of what I've needed to hear this weekend. And thank you, everybody, for the workshops and just making this a fantastic weekend of recovery. I'm going to settle in. Good morning, Toronto. It's nice to be here. So it is an honor to be asked to share my experience, strength, and hope. When I speak my truth, I recover a little bit more. And, you know, in Al-Anon, I've learned I'm only as sick as my secrets, and the truth will set me free. And I want to be free. I do want to be free from the effects of the family disease of alcoholism. So I will talk about what it was like and what got me here and what it's like now. What it was like, I grew up in San Francisco. I have an older sister and a younger sister. Our family looked really good on the outside. And my dad drank every day. My dad was a functioning alcoholic. He went to work 5 days a week. We went on nice family vacations, and the word alcoholism was never used in my house, not once. Before I was born, my dad had an older brother who actually died in a drunk driving car accident, and he widowed his wife and two kids. And so growing up, I just lived in that fear all the time that that would happen in my family. I was born at the intersection of an Irish and Italian family. Are you guys familiar with the Gaelic-garlic combo? It's a combustible mix, if you don't know. There's a long history of alcoholism on the Irish side of my family, and a history of marrying alcoholics on the Italian side of the family. And growing up, you know, in my house, I just thought what was going on was normal. When you're a kid, you don't know any different. And as I got older, I began to realize that what was going on in the house was not okay with me. My dad would come home and drink, and most of the time he would just pass out. But some nights he would do the Jekyll and Hyde, and he would turn and he would become a monster. And dinner plates would fly from the table, furniture would get turned over, language was used, violence was threatened, and then the next day we would all wake up and everybody would pretend like it never happened. And my own real life experience was not being reflected back to me. And the beginning of the insanity began to happen in me because I began to question, is this acceptable? Is this tolerable? Nobody was saying it wasn't. And so what happened as I got older, my dad decided it would be a good idea to buy a restaurant, which I always thought was really an excuse to own a bar. And so if you're familiar with the Bay Area, we live in San Francisco, and he bought a restaurant in Half Moon Bay, which is about a 35-minute drive down the coast along this Highway 1, stretch of Highway 1 called Devil's Slide. So he would go to work and drink all day, and then he would get in the car and do the 35-minute drive back up Devil's Slide. And my sisters and I and my mom, we would just sit in the house and we would hold our breath and wait. And but of course, we never talked about it with each other. And I would just kind of hold my breath and wait for the sound of the garage door to go up. Because once I heard the garage door go up, then I could relax. And I knew that he was safe, he made it home. Now the insanity might have begin to ensue once he got home, but at least I knew where he was. And that was better for me on my nervous system than worrying about, is he gonna make it? And so that really began in me this pattern or process of really living over here and living outside of myself and being really unaware of what's going on in here and being really disconnected from what I need and what's going on with my feelings. I was just living externally. I was outwardly focused. I hated my dad for drinking. I hated my mom for what she put us through. And they violated my love and my trust over and over and over to the point that at 17 or 18, I vowed, as soon as I can get out of here, I want nothing to do with this family, and I will punish you by cutting you out of my life. And I did that to them. When I finished high school, you know, some of my character defects were I just kept my head down, I held my breath, I got good grades, and that was the way that I handled that situation. Just get through it so that you can get out. And there's sort of no plan in that. It's just like, let's just like suffer through this and get through it until it's over. So I got out of the house. I went to college in Santa Barbara, and in my third year, I got a call from my older sister, and she said, you need to come home. Mom is tired of Dad's drinking, and she wants to do an intervention, and you have to be there. And I thought, okay, we're going to talk about his drinking. I want to see that. What is that going to look like? I'm there. So I go home, we do the brief counseling visit with a professional interventionist, and then the next day we all sit around in a circle and surprise him. And we each say how his drinking is affecting us and how we wish that he would stop and get help. And when it was over, he stood up and he said, "Are you done?" And we said, "Yeah." And he said, "Good." And he turned around and he walked out of the house, and I never saw him again after that. He died a year later from end-stage alcoholism. He died from liver cirrhosis and pneumonia. He was 54 years old, and he was found dead in his apartment that he was renting down in Half Moon Bay by his landlady. And the day that my mom walked into my room to tell me that, I think a piece of my soul got ripped out. I was not expecting to hear that. I was still waiting for him to come around. And I had no ability to handle those feelings. And so what I did was I stuffed it. And I blamed him. I said, "He's the bad one. He's the problem. I'm the good one. I get good grades. I do what I'm supposed to do. He's the problem, and now the problem is dead." And I copped a real attitude like that. That's how I got through that situation. And that attitude almost killed me. The same year, you know, I had been living with what I call the disease of chronic self-neglect. When you're outwardly focused all the time, I didn't know who I was, what I needed. So by the time I was 21, that was the year my dad died, I was diagnosed with HIV. And at 26, my HIV had developed to a condition where called neuropathy, which affects the nerves in my feet and my legs. So it makes walking difficult. It creates numbness and stiffness in my legs. And at 28, I had been 5150'd after my second suicide attempt. And you would think that by that point, I would have sought some help in Al-Anon, but it would take me another 13 years to get here. I arrived in Al-Anon on November 6, 2008, a little less than 5 years ago, when I was 41. And so, you know, my dad has died. I drop out of college because I can't keep a focus on school. And I get my first apartment in San Francisco. And I remember there was one night, there was a warm night, it must have been sometime around September, and I was standing out in front of my apartment, and the air was really still and calm and warm. And I was talking with some of my neighbors who lived across the street, and I just had this sense, this feeling of that everything was okay, and that everything had actually always been okay. And I felt this warm embrace from my higher power. I didn't know what to call it back then, but I just felt that the universe had always been with me. And I realized all those years of worrying were for naught, because hadn't I always been okay? And I had survived. Drunk driving car nights over and over with my dad, and all, I had survived it all. I had survived HIV when my friends were dying. And wasn't I okay? And I felt an automatic, just natural internal connection with God. And then as the years went on, I dated alcoholics. And that connection just grew further and further and thinner and more distant, until I felt that there was nothing or no one in the universe that cared about me or loved me. And after 28, after the 5150, I thought, okay, I need to get control of my life. This is a mess. I started therapy. I tried to rebuild my life. I did therapy for 15 years. I started relationships. Like I said, I've only ever dated alcoholics. I went straight from my house to my first roommate in college was an alcoholic. All my roommates after college were alcoholics. I've never dated somebody who wasn't an alcoholic, and I never knew it each time. I had a 7-year relationship with a man who I loved very much. We fought like crazy, and the relationship, you know, I was bringing my denial that I learned in my family into that relationship, and he was wrapped in his denial about his drinking, and it was that same combustible mix all over again. I was repeating the cycle, and I didn't know it. I went straight from that relationship into the relationship that brought me here. This alcoholic was like nothing I'd ever met before. I met him where he worked. He was helping me get fitted for some clothes. And when I was done, I was checking out at the counter. He comes walking up to me at the counter, and he wraps his arms around my waist, and he reaches up and he gives me a big kiss on the lips. And he hands me his card, and he says, "If you want some more of that, give me a call." And I called. And we dated for 4 years, and we loved each other so much, so much. And my therapist used to say, "What is it about the alcoholic and the codependent that you just fit together like a lock and a key?" And we did. And we fought night and day. It was exhausting. We moved in together after a year. You know, that year of dating, I saw red flags with the drinking, but I thought, you know, he has a bad living situation, and as soon as he's out of that bad living situation and living with a nice man like me, then he'll be happy. And you know how that went. So The fighting escalated. You know, there were, I was 40 at the time. Maybe I was having a midlife crisis. I called it love. But I was obsessed with this person, and I was obsessed with the idea that if this man doesn't love me, then I have no one. And now I'm 40 years old, and who's going to love me? Because I have evidence that I'm broken and that I'm unlovable. My dad chose alcohol over staying with his family. And so I just have this evidence that I'm unloved and broken. And so it became the most important thing that he stay. And we would fight so much. Some nights I wanted to push him over the balcony of our fourth floor apartment where we lived. I thought, how am I going to get out of this relationship? I knew it was toxic. I knew I couldn't stay, but I also knew that I didn't want him to leave me. So I was stuck in that double bind. And the fighting escalated. One night I came home, and he's sitting at the kitchen table. He's drunk. And he says, we have to move to Oakland. And I said, why are we moving to Oakland? And he says, my mom's just been arrested. You and I will have to raise my two stepbrothers, and we can't afford to do that here in San Francisco. And I said, okay. I could see he was drunk. I didn't want to have that conversation with him. I wanted to wait until the next morning, but he didn't want to wait. And he's in my face and in my face and in my face. And all I could do was get myself to the bathroom, and I locked the door. And he's banging on the door, pounding on the door, yelling and screaming, and I'm crying, and I am shaking, and I collapsed on the floor, and I realize I am in over my head, and I'm in trouble, and I need help. And, you know, today I know at that moment I surrendered. I it was the first time I asked for help. He left. I went upstairs to take a shower and cool off, and standing there in the shower, I had a moment of clarity. All those fears that I had been living with just disappeared, and there was just like a clear white space, and I looked up, and everything just became clear. I knew three things. He was never going to stop drinking while I was living there, because I was enabling and paying for everything. That I had to leave and move out, and that I had to go to Al-Anon. That week, four people had told me, John, you really ought to check out Al-Anon. Four different people in the same week. That's God. And so the next day, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, and everything began to change. I did ask him, do you want to stop drinking? I can't live like this. And he said, I'm not the one with the problem. When he was right. So I moved out. I gave him 30 days notice, and I moved out. And I was living on my own for the first time in 41 years, and I never put that together. Those first three nights in that apartment were heaven. I was going to bed early. I was sleeping through the night. I wake up in my own place. I was building a new life. I was so happy. And then after about 3 days, that wore off. And I was left with myself. I was left with my disease. And for the first time, I think it was about 3 or 6 months into Al-Anon, I don't know when, but that's when I realized, I'm sick. I need help. And what is this disease that I'm sick with? What is this? This is the first time I'm hearing about the family disease of alcoholism, that you don't have to drink to be affected by the family disease of alcoholism. And so I saw what people were doing in recovery who had what I wanted. They had a sponsor, they were doing service, and they were working the steps. And so I got a sponsor, and I have the same sponsor today that for the past 5 years, and I love this man. God put him in my life. He and I have so many things in common. He's HIV positive for 20 plus years. I'm HIV positive for 24 or 5 years. He had an Irish alcoholic dad who died from alcoholism. My dad was an Irishman who died from alcoholism. He has an unrecovered codependent mother. Same with me. It's just one thing after another. And he has 20 years of recovery under his belt. And he has patiently and gently guided me through the steps. And not once did he ever tell me what to do. And I love that that's how this program works. Because it doesn't work for me when you tell me what to do. But if you show me what you did, then I want to try it. And so that's what he's done. He's modeled his life and he's modeled his recovery for me. And so I do have to admit that for the first 2 years in Al-Anon, I continued to date my qualifier on and off. He would call and I would get together with him. And my sponsor never said, John, maybe you shouldn't be doing that. He never even hinted at it. He would just say things to me like, is it working for you today? And I would say, yeah, we have fun. I love him. And then the day came after 2 years. And that's the clarity that just creeps in and seeps in from working the steps and doing service. I started to feel better about myself. That's what service has done for me. Service is really one of the only things that allows me to hold my head up and makes me feel good about myself. Because the truth is, it's only when I'm doing my higher power's will that I ever felt really good about myself. And so at 2 years, I was able to look at him and say, you know, I think we just want different things. And I don't think that that makes anybody bad, but I just think that makes us not right for each other. And with that, it was over. The obsession was gone. And so I got very involved in doing service at that point. I have done every service position I can at the group level. Last year, I had the opportunity to chair the Al-Anon Committee for the Living Sober Conference in San Francisco. It was a great opportunity. I recommend anyone in Al-Anon to work on an AA conference. It's good recovery. We would sit around at the general planning meetings every month, and it would be me and 20 alcoholics, and we would be discussing the agenda of how the Al-Anon and AA would play out at the conference, and you know they would often be voting against my interests. And at the end of the general planning meetings, they would get up and they would say, you know, so we're going to go to lunch. Do you want to join us? And that's where I began to learn to put principles above personalities. That, like my dad, they have a disease. And that maybe we don't see things the same way, but that didn't mean that my dad didn't love me. And I began to develop a relationship with my dad. And I started to talk with him. And I talk with him every day in the bathroom or in the shower or in the car. And that really began the healing and letting go of the hurt and the anger. And after that service commitment ended, they were asking for people to bring the first Al-Anon meeting ever in the history of San Francisco County Jail. And I did that for 8 months. I brought an Al-Anon meeting every Monday to 48 inmates. And we would sit there. It's a powerful experience to walk in, and they're wearing their orange, everybody's in orange, orange sweatshirts and orange shoes. And we did Al-Anon. And it's a miracle to sit there and watch the light come on as they're realizing, maybe I'm in here because of the effects of the family disease of alcoholism on me. And it was such an honor to share that experience with them and to watch the light come on in them. And those 3 to 5 minutes that we would have when the meeting would end before the guards would escort me out, and to be able to talk with them. And I would just look at them and I would say, go, ask. What do you want to ask? Talk. We have 3 minutes, you know, don't waste it. And it was just you know, what I really took from that experience was enormous gratitude. It shifted my perspective about what I have in my life. And it made me realize that I am no different from them. That while they directed their anger from the family disease of alcoholism outward, I directed mine inward and harmed myself. And that we were no different. And that they just didn't put me in jail for what I did. And that was a really humbling experience. For sure, the service that has meant the most to me has been service in Alateen. 3 years I got certified to become an Alateen sponsor. Alateen meetings in California are for kids 12 through 20 who are affected, who are bothered by somebody who's drinking. And no Alateen meeting can happen without two certified sponsors present. So they need those adults for their meeting to happen. And the people who had really what I wanted were sponsoring an Alateen. And so I was sponsoring our Keep It Simple Monday Night Alateen meeting for about a year, and I was kept hearing about about their conference, NOCAC, it's called, Northern California Alateen Conference. And all the other sponsors that I've been connected with throughout Northern California are telling me, you know, you gotta go to NOCAC, you gotta bring your teens, they're gonna love it, it's gonna be an experience for you. And I'm hearing this stuff like, the teens are in charge of the conference, you do what they tell you to do. They assign your rooms, you stay up until 1 a.m. because that's when they go to bed. You can't leave the property once you register, because we follow the same guidelines that they have to follow, and all my control issues are going off. and they're like, and it's in Fresno. And I apologize if anybody is from Fresno, but that's my ego. I don't go to Fresno. I'm thinking, I don't do that. But that's what I had to do, because if I'm really practicing step one and admitting I'm powerless, then I can go to where the recovery is. And that weekend I had a spiritual experience that changed my life forever. I sat there listening to the opening speakers, two young men sharing their experience, strength, and hope about growing up with their alcoholic fathers, and I heard my story right in front of me. I saw it happening. I'm not one of those people who knows how to get in touch with my inner five-year-old, but I can sit there and I can listen to them, and I see my story, and I remember the stuff that I've stuffed down, and it all came up, and I was sobbing. And my first instinct is, I want to get out of here. You know, anything not working for me, I just bolt. That's my coping mechanism. And it's Friday night, it's just starting, and I'm like, how am I going to get through this weekend? And I just turned to my co-sponsor, my Alateen co-sponsor who's sitting next to me, and I said, I just want to fix it for them. I just want to help them and make it better. And she goes, I know you do. And then she turned her attention back to the speaker. And it was in that moment that I realized why I'm there. I'm there to do the only thing I can do, which is listen. Because when I sit there and listen to their story, I validate their experience. Because in the house I grew up in, we would get into the car every Sunday, and we would drive to one of my relatives' houses 30 minutes away in one of the suburbs, and then my dad would drink all night, and we'd pile into the car. My mom would fight for the keys. She never won, he always drove. And then we'd do the 30-minute drive back to the city, swerving and lane changing, and I'm watching oncoming traffic driving right towards our car. And we'd all sit there in silent terror, and nobody would say anything. And some nights I would get back home and I would think, for sure, tonight this is gonna get talked about. For sure, this time, they're gonna say something. And then the next morning we'd all wake up and act like nothing happened. And the few times that I would try and say anything, my mom would just say, there's nothing wrong here. And if you have a problem, then the problem is you. And so in Alateen, I can sit down and I can look them in the eyes, and they can see in my eyes that I've been through what they've been through. And I can look at them and I can say, I know what you're going through, and it's gonna get better. You're okay, it's gonna get better. Just keep coming back. We don't give advice in Alateen, but I show up I model my Al-Anon behavior to the best of my ability. And the main thing is that I show up. I have been sponsoring that meeting for 3 years. I've missed one meeting in 3 years because that's all I can do. I can bring them to area events and I can show up. In August, I drove five of our teens up to the Oregon Alateen Conference, and we rented a big van, and we stopped at Crater Lake, and we did a meditation on the rim of the lake, and then we drove to the conference, and we just laughed the whole way up and had fun and had the meeting in the car. And then we got to the conference and just listened to all the teens share, and we cried, all of us. We just cried all weekend long. And by taking them to those events and by showing up and listening, I get validated. And I found myself worth an Alateen service. And I'll always be grateful for that because I looked for that my whole life. I had no self-esteem. I knew it was a problem. I didn't know how to fix it. I didn't know how to change it. And I found it showing up doing service for those kids. I won't go through all the steps, but I do want to touch on some of the things that have been pivotal, that has really worked for me and really changed my life. I spent a year on step one. I just needed that time to adjust to life in recovery. I needed to learn principles of the program like compassion and patience and love and gratitude and forgiveness. I knew nothing about those things when I got here. And then I reopened the Daily Reader one day, and it says, compassion is accepting people for who they are and loving them still. I never accepted anyone in my life. I never accepted my dad or my mom or my friends or myself. I tried to change everyone. And so I'm beginning this, learning this process of compassion, which made the rest of the steps possible. I did not like that word, sanity, in step two. That word scared me. And then my sponsor gave me this incredible gift, and he said, if you think you know what that word means, why don't you look it up? And so I did that, and I continue to do that today with everything in program and in my life. And, one of the definitions of the word sanity is wholeness of mind. And one of the definitions of the word insanity is a belief in an untruth. And that was less scary to me. And I could see that my life had become insane because I was believing a lot of things that were not true about myself, about my family, about the world, and that doing the steps has been a process of eliminating those old ideas, those wrong ideas that I hold about myself. Nowhere in the steps does it say I need to add anything to me to make me whole. It's been a process of eliminating. The other thing that really worked for me in step two was I just finally had to ask myself, John, are you willing to believe in the possibility that there is a God, and a God that loves you and wants what's best for you? And so I just began doing that. And within a very short amount of time, my higher power revealed to me that there is a God. And I just keep doing that every day. And today I have stacks and stacks of evidence that there is a loving higher power in my life who only wants what's best for me. One of the first meetings that I was asked to speak at was February the 25th. And on February the 23rd, I don't know what came over me, but I started looking up what I could find about my dad on the internet, and I found his birth certificate, his marriage license, his death certificate. You can find all that stuff online. And I had been estranged from my family for years. I couldn't even tell you that my dad's birthday. I'd forgotten, and wasn't talking to anyone in my family. Couldn't ask. And I look, and the date of his death was February the 25th, the night I was speaking. And it was the 20-year anniversary of his death. And I got to sit there at that meeting and share about my experience growing up with the family disease of alcoholism to a room full of people who understood and who cared and who loved me. And I cried. I cried so bad that night, a sound came out of me. I didn't know what it was. I didn't even know it was coming from me. It took me a second to realize, what is that sound? Oh my God, it's me. And I didn't know what it was. And you know what it was? It was grief. That was the beginning of, I started grieving. And grieving just sounds like this deep, ugly crying that lasts for hours. And that's what I needed to do. I needed to grieve those old feelings, because you have to heal it, you have to feel it to heal it. So I went on and did the third step with my sponsor. I spent 6 months on the third step, and what I really realized when I was done was I'm going to make this decision every day, and then I'm going to carry it out by doing service and by doing 4 through 9, and that, you know, and let's just move on with this inventory. I did that. I spent a year, 9 months on the fourth step, and when I was done, I had this list of assets and defects, and I say to my sponsor, okay, so, you know, judging, controlling, perfectionist, low self-esteem, self-righteous, you know, this is what I'm recovering from. And underneath all of that is fear. Is fear the exact nature of my wrongs? And he says, I don't know. That's a good question. So we're doing the fifth step, and there's a question in Paths to Recovery, and it says, make a list of the people that you trust who you'd be willing to do your fifth step with. And so as a result of doing service, I had spoken at a conference a couple years ago, and I met a woman named Nancy B. from Colorado. Nancy has 36 years in Al-Anon. She's the only person I'd ever met at that point who has served on the board of trustees of Al-Anon. And at the end of the conference, she hands me her card and she says, stay in touch. And I said, what are we gonna talk about? And she goes, I don't know, just call. So I do. I call her every Monday. We do a book study together for an hour, and we do recovery. So I said to my sponsor, I said, I want to ask Nancy to do my fifth step. And he says, okay, ask her. So one day we're doing the book study, and I said, I have a big question, and take your time, but I want to know if I can come to Colorado and do my fifth step with you. And without even hesitating, she goes, when are you coming? She lives 3 hours up in the Rockies. She drove 6 hours round trip to pick me up at the Denver airport. So we're driving up the mountain, and she says, I said, so, you know, controlling, perfectionism, judging, fears underneath all that is fear the exact nature of my wrongs. And she says, no, fear is a feeling, and feelings are not defects. But the behaviors that we do in reaction to not wanting to feel the feelings are the exact nature of our wrongs. On page 18 in How Al-Anon Works, it talks about the 5 major symptoms of our disease: anger, guilt, denial, obsession, anxiety. Those are the obsessive and anxious and angry ways that I would use my character defects alcoholically, obsessively, so that I didn't have to feel my feelings, when really all I could have done was just feel the feeling. And today I've learned that doesn't kill me, but I did not want to feel what it felt like to hear, John, your dad just died. John, you're HIV positive. John, you have a permanent disability. I couldn't feel those feelings. And so I created an insane and painful place for myself to live. As a result of doing the fifth step with Nancy that weekend, I won't go into all the details, but miracles happened. I slipped and I fell on the ice in Colorado, and I sprained my wrist. And so we're sitting in the hospital having an x-ray doing the fifth step, and which takes hours, so you know you might as well do the fifth step. And she starts telling me about a story that happened in her family. She has an alcoholic Irish husband named Tom. My dad's an alcoholic Irishman named Tom. They have 3 kids. We have 3 kids in my family. And she starts telling me about trouble that she had with her son. And I start looking at my friend, Nancy, like Nancy the mom. And I start seeing how I owe my mom an amends. And so when I got back to San Francisco, I said to my sponsor, I said, I want to reach out to my mom. Is it time? And he says, I think it is. And so I wrote her a card, and I said, you know, I know a lot has passed, but I want you to know that I love you, And I'm grateful for everything that you've done for me in my life. And if you'd like to get together over dinner and talk, I'd love to see you. And I mean, talk about let go and let God. When I dropped that card in the mail, I held on to that card for a week, and this is God showing up. One of my clients showed up at work with an alcoholic father and a codependent mother, and she walked in and she was crying, and she said, I said, what's wrong? And she goes, my mom just died. She dropped dead of a heart attack unexpectedly. And she sobbed. I dropped that card in the mail that day. And that was God showing up and doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And you know, it didn't take that long. In 5 days, she sent me an email. The first time I received an email from my mom in years. And she said, I thank you for your card. It was beautiful. And I'd be willing to meet you for lunch during the week. And I showed it to my sponsor. I'm like, she said yes. And you know, Nancy had said to me, can you tell your mom that you love her and accept a no? And I said, no. And she said, well, then you're not ready. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, real love is unconditional. You want to tell your mom you love her and you're expecting a result. And she said, can you accept a no? And I said, no. And she's like, well, you're not ready then. And I was like, damn. Because I knew she was right. And so I had to be able to be willing to accept a no. But what happened was she said yes. But if she had said no, that would have been okay too. Because when I dropped that card in the mail, my side of the street was clean. And thank you, Al-Anon Family Groups, for that. For giving me my family back and giving me my life back. My mom and I sat down in April for the first time in over 20 years and had lunch together, just the two of us. In July, we had dinner, and last month, we drove to see my dad's only living sister. And I was able to sit there and listen as she talked about the divorce that she's about to start going through at 75 years old. And that was unexpected news. But I could sit there and listen without giving advice. And when it was over, she just hugged me and said, I'm so grateful for you. And I cried because I haven't heard that from my mom in a long time. I do want to talk about what it's like now. You know, what my life is like today is just a daily process of doing steps 1, 2, and 3. I wake up every morning, and the first thing I do is I pray and meditate. And I turn over the thing that I'm powerless over, the thing that I feel the most powerless over. And I get on my knees, and I say, God, today I am powerless over this share. And obsessing about it and worrying about it makes my life unmanageable. I have come to believe you have the power to restore me to sanity. And so today I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to your loving care. And I pray for knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry it out. And then I sit and I meditate for 10 minutes. And that's what I do every day. And each day it's just a process of listening for his guidance and his will for me. And it's amazing the miracles that happen in my life when I do that. I live my whole life trying to force and control everything. Try living with a walking disability. It will put your control issues through the roof. And so a couple of years ago, I was having a lot of difficulty with trying to date in recovery. It wasn't working for me. And so I just took a year off from dating and dedicated that time to my recovery. And it was amazing how much time you have when you're not trying to date. And how much time I had to dedicate to service and to Alateen and to my recovery. And then that year ended and everybody was like, are you gonna date now? Who are you dating? And you know, nothing happened. Like no guys miraculously showed up. But another 6 months go by, and then another year went by, and I was starting to get nervous. And I thought, well, maybe I better do some more footwork here. And I was getting ready to create a dating profile. And but you know, during that whole time, I always trusted that my higher power had a relationship for me if that's what he had in store for me. And so 6 weeks ago, I was invited to speak at the San Diego conference. It was a beautiful conference over Labor Day weekend. And I'm sitting there at the back of the meeting, opening night, the Friday night AA speaker gets up, and it's this man, Mark, from San Francisco, who I know. And he looks at me, and his jaw drops. And I go up to hug him and thank the speaker afterwards. And he gives me a big hug, and he looks at me, and he says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm here for the same reason you're here. I'm here for the recovery." And he says, "Good for you." And so we hung out, and we're talking over the weekend, and just very subtle flirtation, very light, polite. And at the end of the weekend, he says, "When we get back to San Francisco, would you like to go out?" And I said, "Yes, I would." And so he called when we got back. And so for the past 6 weeks, I've been dating a person who I adore, who I share recovery with, who can show up and listen. He's been through some difficult stuff in recovery, and he's been able to talk about that and cry in front of me, and I've been able to sit there and listen and not interfere in his grief process. And he said to me afterwards one night, he goes, "You know what, John, when we sat there and talked together that night and you just allowed me to have that process, it made me feel safe with you." And that means so much to me. So, you know, I'm grateful for that relationship. I don't know where it will go, but I trust that my higher power will guide me through whatever is supposed to happen. But I am grateful to have a relationship with somebody who has 14 years of sobriety and is in Al-Anon. My friend Marcel says, "It's just better that way." And I agree. So in closing, I want to just say, you know, for years, I regretted the past. My whole life was about just regretting. I wasn't supposed to be HIV positive. My dad wasn't supposed to die. I wasn't supposed to be disabled. That wasn't supposed to happen. And that regret consumed me. And in recovery, I can take those experiences and I can turn them into something positive for myself and my sponsees and for the teens and for other people. And that is such a beautiful gift. That is a miracle that I can take those experiences that haunted me and spin them into gold and make them something that helps my life and someone and touch someone else. I can't change the past, but I can take those experiences and use them to launch my life into what's next. I'm grateful for 12-step. I love the AA and Al-Anon community. I'm grateful for getting my life back, for my family back in my life, for what might be the first healthy adult relationship in my life. And I'm grateful for you guys. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.